All right, good morning, everybody. October 18th, Monday morning, 11:17. And we're going to pick it up where we left off. Actually, before we pick it up where we left off, I'm going to tell everybody that I put the test on Canvas and activated it just a few minutes ago. I made a due date of next Monday, so you've got a week to complete the test. And that should give you guys time to be able to go in, look at it, figure out what you need to do, do some work over the weekend and finish it up. So just so that we're all on the same page, the quizzes, the exam, all of those materials, I'm making exactly the same as if I would have done them in class. The quizzes that I've been giving you are normally a 15-minute format for that type of quiz, even though I've been leaving it open for several days or a week, I think, as I've been doing with the quizzes. The exam would normally be an hour and a half exam, in-class exam, and it would be open book, open note. So it's no different really than having you guys have access to computers, because I've never even restricted the use of computers within the classroom before for taking those exams. So it's the exact same format that it would be in class. It's just got an extended time format for you to allow flexibility for people who I know have difficult schedules. You may have work issues and some ability then to also be able to get together and collaborate on some of these. And I'm okay if you're collaborating even on the exam. I think that those are great things to discuss and to talk about the problems and to get different viewpoints. And the way I look at it is I'm looking at your work and assessing your work, even though you may be collaborating, your work may be different than the person that you're collaborating with. And I just think it benefits everybody to work together. So I'm fine with that. I don't have any problem with you guys working together on the exams and things, just so that everybody's on the same page. Let's see, is there anything else I need to tell you on that? I don't think so. I think that's about everything. Let me go ahead and start a screen share. And see if this comes up on the cable the way it's supposed to. It is. All right. So today is alcohols part two. This chapter in our textbook is broken up into two different chapters. One is the synthesis of alcohols primarily, and the second one is the utilization of alcohols. So that's where we're at on this part. This is going to be the utilization of alcohols to do some different things. So let's see what we can do here. Part one, this is what we did before. This was the synthesis. Of alcohols and diols. And part two that we're going to undertake now, this is the use of alcohols to make other functional groups. And some of these, again, are review, very similar to what we did in the beginning of this chapter when we did part one, synthesis of alcohols. We went through all the different synthesis reactions that we had previously done in other chapters. We do the same thing here, same sort of idea. So reactions that are review. Number one, we had SN1 reactions where we could use an alcohol. So we could have, that is not a good drawing, Jason. All right, so there's tertiary butanol. And if we took tertiary butanol and reacted it with HBr, we can do an SN1 where we could substitute this and turn it into a bromide. Not a very controlled type of reaction, because you guys remember that what happens here is it protonates, it goes through a good leaving group, goes through the carbocation, once this leaving group pops off, and that carbocation can undergo rearrangements. And so this isn't a very controlled reaction. It's a little risky in trying to get the exact product that you want because of all the rearrangements that can happen. The SN2 reactions that we looked at are a little bit more controlled, but they have some issues as well. So one of the things that we looked at that we could do is we could take an alcohol and HBr. And we can do an SN2 reaction where we knock out the leaving group. So very similar to the last reaction, we pick up the proton, we create a good leaving group, but this is now on a primary carbon. So it doesn't want to leave on its own. And the bromide then is able to come in and do the backside attack and knock the group out to do the SN2 reaction. So that's much more controlled. You could do this with chlorides as well, but the chlorides are not as good a nucleophile. And so because the chloride is not as good a nucleophile, they need a little bit of help. And we usually use something like zinc chloride in here. But it's still an SN2. Sometimes, however, bromides and chlorides can only take you so far. And so if you want a better leaving group, then the better leaving group is to go and to look at using a tosylate. So we can take an alcohol and we can treat it with tosyl chloride and pyridine. And we can convert this into the tosylate. And then that can be reacted with HCl. Now that we've got a better leaving group, or actually we can even say HX. And as a reminder that this is an SN2 reaction, we get inversion of configuration at that point. So this point here, that's the SN2 component. This mechanism, this piece here, we've gone over that mechanism previously. I'll remind you again that the way that that mechanism works is that we have the tosyl chloride . I may not have enough room to do this entire mechanism here. I may have to spread it onto the next page. The oxygen attacks the sulfur. One of the carbonyls opens up, pushing the electrons up onto the oxygen. We get a sulfur that has a whole lot of things connected to it now. But sulfur is large and has d orbitals, can expand its octet. So we got all those things connected. The carbonyl closes back up, ejects out the chloride. And then the last thing that happens is the base removes the proton. And that is the last step in making the tosylate. So there's the tosylate, and that's the piece that we refer to as OTS. So that TS group, even the oxygen that we're referring to there, that's the tosylate group as it sits. Now, the one thing to note here is that the oxygen that was the oxygen of the alcohol, that oxygen still persists, and so the stereocenter is not changed. The stereocenter, when we look at it, stereocenter here is the same stereocenter here. It's unaffected because the reaction is at the oxygen, not at the carbon. That makes sense? And so it's not until we get the SN2 reaction where we have the halogen come in and knock this guy out that we get the inversion of configuration. So all of these reactions are reactions that we've seen before. And I have a couple others that we've seen before I want to add to this, but we haven't really discussed their mechanisms in any great detail. So these reactions are also SN2 reactions. We can take an alcohol and we can react it with a reagent called thionyl chloride. This is also done in pyridine. Sometimes that thionyl chloride is written SOCl2. These guys are equivalent ways of writing thionyl chloride. This will smoothly convert the alcohol into a chloride, and it does it in a very similar way in which we make the thionyl, the sulfonyl chloride. It works almost the same mechanism. So it's kind of a nice mechanism to actually look at as well. In this case, what winds up happening is the oxygen attacks the sulfur, breaks the carbonyl bond, pushes the electrons up onto the oxygen of that carbonyl. In this case, the carbonyl closes back up, ejects out a leaving group. And now this whole piece, this piece here, becomes the leaving group. So it's the protonated oxygen connected to this whole thing that becomes the leaving group, and the chloride is now the nucleophile that comes in and attacks this. So this is an SN2 reaction at its heart, at its core, in terms of the chloride coming in and knocking out that oxygen. And that whole group leaves. It goes to that guy. And the end result of the thionyl chloride is that the, how do I draw this? I didn't draw this exactly right. Let me redraw this arrow. I'll do it in red so that we can track it. This arrow comes this way. Nope, one more time. I know what's wrong. I need to do one more step in here before I get to the leaving group. I got to get rid of that proton first. I jumped the gun, I apologize. Let's get rid of the proton with the base. And now I'll show you. The chloride comes in, knocks out the leaving group. But the way in which this works is it knocks out the chloride as well, such that that arrow is not quite correct. This comes up here, and the other two parts that come out of this is sulfur dioxide, which is a gas, SO2. And so that leaves the reaction vessel. We also generated the base that picked up the proton. That has a positive charge and the counter ion that came with it. And that is a solid that precipitates out. And so it's a fairly easy reaction to do because you get your chloride after using the thionyl chloride, the sulfur dioxide leaves as a gas, and the pyridinium chloride precipitates out as a solid. So all you need to do is filter this at the end, and you've got a fairly nice clean separation of all of the components that went into it. The mechanism on this isn't super critical, but what's nice to see is the same sort of conserved idea of attack at the sulfur, opening of the oxygen, closing of the oxygen, ejecting of the chloride. It's very similar to the last reaction that we looked at. It's just that this can break down into sulfur dioxide that allows the reaction to progress. So my apologies on fumbling that mechanism a little bit, but that's the thionyl chloride. There's another reaction that's related to this that we can take an alcohol and we can turn it into a bromide. And this is done with PBr3. And it makes the bromide. This reaction also is SN2, essentially, and it works very similar to the other reaction. In all of these, what we're doing is we're taking some sort of heavier element, a sulfur or a phosphorus. We're putting electronegative groups on it in order to make it a strong electrophile. The oxygen attacks that strong electrophile, usually knocking out some leaving group. And then that creates a new leaving group, essentially. And the halogen can come back in and kick out that leaving group. And I believe that this can use more than just one of the bromides on the PBr3. I think it can use at least two, if not all three of them. So that's another way that we can make halogens. So those two reagents, thionyl chloride and PBr3, we've had before, but we haven't really looked at their mechanisms in great detail. So I wanted to take a moment and show you those. So these are all inherently SN2 steps. And so we've covered SN1, we've covered SN2. We've got some elimination reactions that we did. So let's look at some E1s. In the E1 reactions, we used acid and heat, and we were able to undergo the elimination. So in these E1 reactions, we're just picking up the proton, creating a good leaving group. It goes through the carbocation, which again is difficult to control because you may get different types of rearrangements. And then some base in solution pulls the proton to give us the elimination. So there's the E1. Just to highlight that idea that we can get rearrangements or that we can get different things occurring. If we have a tertiary alcohol where we have some different patterns going on or elimination possibilities, look at H2SO4 and heat. We can get elimination that leads to different substitution patterns. Disubstituted, trisubstituted. So remember these concepts, that when we look at how substituted the double bond is, that one of these, the less substituted, can usually occur faster, but is less thermodynamically stable. So we call this a kinetic product. The other one that's more substituted is more thermodynamically stable, but has a higher activation energy for its formation. This one is the thermodynamic. And those have different conditions that promote them. Do you remember the conditions that promote a kinetic product? Do you remember how you choose conditions in order to select for a kinetic product? This isn't about changing the base, because right now all we're doing is we're using acid and heat. So the question is, what conditions promote a kinetic product over a thermodynamic?
You use less heat.
What's that?
Use less heat, I think.
Less heat, yeah. So this is colder temp and shorter reaction time. And the other one is just the reverse, higher heat and longer reaction times. Excellent. Okay, and along these lines, we can also look at E2 reactions, where we could take and convert the alcohol into a tosylate, a good leaving group. Once we get it into a good leaving group, then we can choose to react it with a base like sodium ethoxide. And we can eliminate it in the E2 reaction. So all of those things are reviewed. All of those things, I know I went through them fairly quickly, but I backed up and I showed the mechanism for almost everything that we were doing there. All of that is review. Now what we've got is a couple reactions which are new reactions. So the main component is oxidation and looking at how we can oxidize alcohols into different functional groups. So this is a starting component on oxidation. So oxidation is the gain of oxygen or loss of hydrogen. Usually we couch it not in the organic terms of the gain of oxygen or loss of hydrogen. That's more useful for us, but usually what we say is oxidation is loss. And by that, we mean loss of electrons. So as we lose electrons, we undergo what's called an oxidation. When we look at oxidations of alcohols, one of the things that we note is that on a primary alcohol, there are two protons that are adjacent to the alcohol. When we undergo oxidation, we can undergo stepwise oxidation. We'll have to show how to do this. There's a number of different steps that are involved, but the first oxidation, this is the symbol that we use for oxidation. The first step takes you to an aldehyde. And then the second step in oxidation takes you to a carboxylic acid. And notice that as long as we have one proton that is adjacent to the, that is attached to the carbon of the carbon that contains the oxygen, that we can undergo oxidation. When we look at a secondary alcohol, the secondary alcohol only has one proton. It can go undergo oxidation to become a ketone. And ketones, if you try to oxidize them further, won't undergo any reaction. So we say no reaction. Ketones cannot be oxidized further from their ketone state. And the reason is because that proton, unlike the aldehyde, they don't have a proton attached to that carbon anymore. And so it's really these protons that are allowing for the oxidation to occur. If there's no proton, there's no possibility of oxidation. That can be seen further in looking at a tertiary alcohol. That if you try to oxidize a tertiary alcohol, there's no reaction. Again, because there's no proton attached to the carbon that also contains the oxygen. There needs to be that proton there adjacent to the oxygen in order for it to undergo an oxidation reaction. We'll show why that is. We'll go through the reaction mechanism. But that's, yeah.
I have a question really quick. I know we're talking about oxidation, and so we're going in the forward direction here. But really right. Quick, could we have a ketone and go reverse with reduction to go back to the alcohol?
Absolutely. Yes. And so these processes, while we're looking at this, I'm going to do it in gray. We can go back by reduction. We could always reduce the aldehyde and go back to the alcohol. The carboxylic acid, likewise, could be reduced and go back to the aldehyde or back to the alcohol. So yes, we can do these by reduction, and there are reagents that will allow us to do these steps. The ketone, as you said, can also be reduced. We can use sodium borohydride and you can go back to the alcohol. So these are the reverse of the reactions that we were looking at in the first chapter on the alcohols, where we were looking at reductions on how to make alcohols, right? Because that was our synthesis component. This is how do we use alcohols? What can we turn alcohols into? And we're finding that by the reverse process, by oxidation, absolutely, we can oxidize these. So yeah, these are reverse reactions, essentially.
Cool, thanks.
That's a great point. Thank you for that.
All right, so when we start to look at oxidations, there are two main oxidizing reagents. Let's see, how do I want to say this? I don't want to say two main oxidizing. I'm going to say two strong oxidizing reagents. Because we're going to cover many oxidizing reagents, but there are two in particular that are really strong oxidizing reagents, and they're related to each other. One of them we looked at already. This is the chromic acid. It's CrO3 and H2SO4. And usually this is done in acetone. And this one is what is called Jones reagent. And it's chromic acid oxidation. The two components of combining the chromium 6 oxide plus H2SO4, when you combine these two together, they combine to generate the chromic acid. And the chromic acid is the oxidizing agent itself. So that's the chromic acid. The second one
is related to Jones. I think it's called the Cornforth. I don't use that name very often. I need to look it up and make sure. I think it's called Cornforth reagent. It is sodium dichromate, Na2CR207. And that is then treated with H2SO4 and water. And this is very similar. They both make chromic acid. And they're both extremely strong oxidizing reagents. So the main thing that you're looking for in these situations is you're looking at the chromium, which is a hexavalent chromium. You're looking at chromium, which is in a plus six state. And I believe we're at plus six and plus six would be plus 12. 2 times 7 is 14. And there's your two counter ions, the two sodiums. So each of these chromiums are plus six hexavalent chromium. And it's that plus six chromium, which is really the oxidizing agent in each of these. So this mechanism, I don't know that we looked at the entire mechanism. I can go back through it. I think I showed it to some degree. It's actually nice to see this juxtaposed against the other mechanism, so I think it's worth repeating. In these mechanisms, what we have is we have the alcohol that we're looking at oxidizing and the chromic acid. The first step is the protonation of the alcohol itself. Once you get the protonation, the remaining chromic acid, the chromate ion, can use the electrons to do an SN2 step to push out the oxygen. And this is the step where that proton becomes critically important. So we said that there were two protons that are attached at this position here. These were the two green protons that I was highlighting before. And we said that those two protons are necessary for oxidation to occur, because what happens is the base, like a water, whatever it is, pulls that proton. And this critical step here, where these electrons get pushed into a double bond there, breaking these electrons, and those go to the chromium. That's the actual oxidation step. That's where the oxidation is really occurring. So now the chromium has the lone pair. The chromium has moved into a plus three state and accepting the electrons. And the oxygen component has been oxidized and is now an aldehyde. The aldehyde can similarly be oxidized, but the main part here is that the hexavalent chromium, the plus six, starts out in an orange color. So this guy, this chromium is orange, just in color. The plus three state turns green. And so you know that the reaction is completed when the reaction turns from orange to green. you know that all of your hexavalent chromium is reacted and is now turned into chromium 3+. So that's the oxidation component and the mechanism that we go through. And both of the Joan reagents work in the same sort of way. Oh, it was not the Cornforth reagent. So now I don't know what this one is, because now the other one, and now I know which one is the Cornforth. We'll go through that in a minute. All right, so the problem here, here's the problem with this. When we take a primary alcohol and we oxidize it using Jones, it goes through the aldehyde. And it does not stop. It goes all the way to the carboxylic acid. And the reason is that an aldehyde is more easily oxidized than the alcohol. And because the aldehyde is more easily oxidized, it doesn't matter if you try to limit it with one equivalent. If you try to limit it with one equivalent, let me say one equivalent of Jones reagent, what winds up happening is you will get some alcohol, you will get some aldehyde, and you will get some carboxylic acid. And the ratios of alcohol to aldehyde to carboxylic acid are all over the map. There's no way to limit this because the aldehyde is just so much more oxidizable. So really what happens is you get very small amounts of the aldehyde. And the majority is the carboxylic acid and the alcohol. And there's just no way to really stop it at the aldehyde because the aldehyde is just too reactive. So what happens is when we get situations like that and you can't get the aldehyde, then chemists take that as a personal challenge and they say, all right, Mother Nature doesn't give me the aldehyde, but I want the aldehyde. How do I get the aldehyde? Because now all of a sudden the aldehyde becomes sort of precious because you can't get it normally under these sorts of reaction conditions. When that type of thing happens, chemists expend great amounts of effort to find a reaction, to find a way to change the reaction mechanism to get the thing that they want, to get the aldehyde. So then they start exploring different ways of getting that. One of the things that they found was to change the reagent from an acidic reagent to a basic reagent, still using chromium, but making the reaction work under basic conditions as opposed to acidic conditions. One of the reasons that the aldehyde reacts so fast is that under acidic conditions, and Jones is very acidic, that's chromic acid, under acidic conditions, when we look at the alcohol, the first step in the alcohol was the protonation of the alcohol to create this guy. The aldehyde, when protonated, is much more reactive. This is a much larger partial positive than that guy. And so when the aldehyde is protonated under those strongly acidic conditions, this is a stronger electrophile. So how do I stop the aldehyde from being attacked? I change the reaction conditions to basic conditions.
And we try to do oxidation under basic conditions. So here's what they did. What they did is they said, all right, chromic acid is too strong an acid. I'm going to attenuate it by putting a base in with the chromic acid. And what they decided to use was a base that we're familiar with, that we've seen a number of times. They decided to use pyridine. So they used pyridine, plus they used chromium 6 oxide, plus they used HCl, and they created a reagent that has a pyridinium ion, which is not really acidic. It's got a positive charge on it, but that proton is pretty locked up with the nitrogen, and it's the counter ion for CrO3Cl. And this CrO3Cl has a negative charge on it. This whole thing is a complex that is called pyridinium chlorochromate. And that guy is called PCC, pyridinium chlorochromate. And it's called Corey's reagent. So PCC, Corey's reagent, was developed to be basic in nature to prevent over-oxidation. And what PCC can do is we can now take a primary alcohol and we can oxidize it with PCC and it will stop at the aldehyde. It will not go on further. And it doesn't go on any further because it doesn't protonate the aldehyde, and the aldehyde does not then become attacked. The reagent works in a different way. There's another very similar reagent to this one. The one that's very similar is made up of two pyridinium ions. And it's made up of the dichromate, Cr2O7. And this one is pyridinium dichromate. And so this one is PDC, pyridinium dichromate. And this one is the one that's called Swarnforth reagent. This is the one that I was struggling to remember. Usually we don't use them by name. Usually I use PDC or I use PCC. That's how I refer to them. And PDC will do the same thing that PCC does. It just gives me other options. So here again, I could take a primary alcohol. Let's use a different. Primary alcohol, PDC, stops at the aldehyde. Again, because it's basic in nature instead of acidic. I don't know if I have that whole mechanism. Maybe I do. No, I don't. It's essentially the same. The same sort of idea is happening. The proton is getting pulled. The electrons are transferring to the oxygen and to the chromium, and the oxidation occurs. It's just that there's no additional protonation, and therefore the aldehyde does not get attacked and then does not go through the oxidation.
So that's mainly what's occurring there. So two new reagents, PCC, pyridinium chlorochromate, and PDC, pyridinium dichromate, that allow us to do oxidations and to stop at the aldehyde. There's one more important oxidation reaction, and I usually like to include it because it's really a beautiful mechanism. You don't see it quite as much as you see these two, but the main thing with these two is that when we look at the chromium that we're using, this chromium is a plus six, and this chromium is a plus six. And do you remember what I said about plus six chromium, hexavalent chromium? What was the danger with hexavalent chromium?
Like quick carcinogenic.
Yeah, exactly. And so all of these reagents, Jones reagent, Corey's reagent, Cornforth's reagent, PCC, PDC, they're all strong carcinogens. Wouldn't it be nice to have an oxidizing reagent that wasn't a strong carcinogen, something that we could use that that would do this job, but would not just oxidize everything and wouldn't be carcinogenic? That's the next one that we want to show. So that's, this one is called Swern oxidation. And this one is just a beautiful little mechanism. So Swern oxidation is a mild oxidation. I think about chromic acid Jones as being strong, almost like a sledgehammer. Swern is a mild oxidation. It works under very mild conditions. And it looks like this. We take an alcohol, primary or secondary. We use a reagent that is called oxalyl chloride. It has different ways in which it's written. So that's the oxalyl chloride. I'll give it its name. It's derived from oxalic acid. We use DMSO, dimethyl sulfoxide, and we use triethylamine. It's also done at very cold temperatures. It's usually done somewhere around minus 78 to 0 degrees C, but it's usually done fairly cold. And it will oxidize the alcohol up to the ketone. So let me show you how this mechanism works, because that's the really beautiful part in this. The mechanism, unlike the others, doesn't start with the alcohol. The mechanism starts with the oxalyl chloride and the DMSO. So DMSO, dimethyl sulfoxide, is this reagent, but we can draw a resonance contributor for it that explains sort of its reactivity. This is the resonance contributor for DMSO. And this resonance contributor is important to draw because it explains how the oxygen works as a nucleophile in DMSO, which you wouldn't really think of if you didn't draw that resonance contributor. That oxygen attacks the oxalyl chloride, breaking the carbon-oxygen bond and moving the electrons up onto the oxygen. Okay, so we get to this guy. Oh, and the lone pairs are still on that sulfur. All right, any ideas? What happens next? given the carbonyl patterns that we've seen three times now? When the carbonyl opens up and becomes an O minus, what does it usually like to do after it opens up to an O minus?
Pulls in a hydrogen.
Usually it can get protonated, but we've seen a different pattern here multiple times where we open up the carbonyl, it goes to what we call a tetrahedral intermediate, and then it snaps back in and ejects out something. So here it snaps back in to regenerate the carbonyl and it kicks out a leaving group. And it's that chloride that's acting as a leaving group. Remember how we've seen the chloride act as a leaving group numerous times now, right? We've seen this over with the metals, with various things where the chromium is where the chlorine is attached, and the chlorine always gets kicked out as a leaving group. So once that chlorine gets kicked out, this now has the oxygen connected to the sulfur, and the sulfur has a positive charge on it. The chlorine comes in and attacks that sulfur. So the chlorine with the minus charge comes in and attacks the sulfur. And in doing that, it's like an SN2 reaction. This guy leaves, but when it leaves, it pushes the electrons in. And when it pushes those electrons in, this bond is breaking. This bond then fragments here. These electrons go this way. And this bond fragments, and these electrons go that way. So the result of all of that breakdown, that whole thing, goes through a cascade sort of breakdown reaction. And this is the really elegant part. So now what we create is a sulfur that has the chlorine on it. We've got two methyl groups still attached to that sulfur. So we've created that guy, and that has a positive charge still. But the other part has broken down into this. That guy. That guy. And that guy. So these two things, this is carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide. And these are each gases. And those two gases just leave the reaction vessel. So we make carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide out of that. And then this is now the active oxidizing agent. So now what happens with that is that gets attacked by the alcohol. So the alcohol comes in, attacks the sulfur, kicking out the chloride. I need a deprotonation step here. I probably should have deprotonated that before I attacked it. Because now I've got two positives and I don't like two positives. But we'll get rid of the slight bobble in my mechanism.
Why do you not like two positives? Because it's kind of not really happening that way?
Usually you wouldn't get two positives that are adjacent to each other like that. I mean, if I wanted to fix this mechanism, I'd have to back up. Let me fix it. I hate it when it doesn't look right. I think what I need to do is I need to deprotonate this first. And let's just use a general base. The triethylamine is really what does it. All right, this is better. This guy now comes in, attacks that, kicks out the chloride. That's way better. Usually you don't want to have two adjacent positive charges, just in the same way you don't want to have two adjacent negative charges. We don't get two positives together, two negatives together. If your mechanism, if you're drawing your mechanism and that happens, that means you've made a mistake someplace in your mechanism because that's just generally too high in energy. It doesn't generally work out that way. But now what we've got is we've got the oxygen connected to this. The sulfur still has a positive charge now. And the last step in this is the removal of that proton. This is the adjacent proton that we keep talking about. Another equivalent of base is going to take this proton. Those electrons transfer into that oxygen bond. Those electrons transfer into that bond. And we end up with everything that I'm going to tally here. So we end up with our oxidized alcohol. So this is our ketone. We end up with an equivalent of dimethyl sulfide. This is a gas. We've ended up with CO2. That was a gas. We ended up with carbon monoxide. That was a gas. And we've ended up with two equivalents of triethyl ammonium chloride. And that is a solid. And that solid precipitates out. So the beautiful thing, the thing that I love about this mechanism going all the way back, is that we started with these reagents, we started with oxalyl chloride, DMSO, and triethylamine. And when all is said and done, we end up with three different gases that leave the reaction vessel and a solid that precipitates out of the reaction vessel. And by Le Chatelier's principle, whenever you remove a product, it shifts the equilibrium more towards products. And so this is a very high yielding reaction that doesn't have a whole lot to isolate away from it because most of it is blown off into gases and precipitates out as a solid. So it becomes a very easy workup. And to me, reactions like that are just super elegant.
So then you don't need much of a purification step either because exactly. You filter it out.
Exactly. So it's super easy in its purification. And you can get the ketone, you can get the oxidized component really cleanly. So it's just a beautiful little reaction in terms of the Swern oxidation. A little bit harder to do, but extremely satisfying in how clean the reaction is, and there's no carcinogens. So that's the selling point for me. That's a really beautiful reaction mechanism. Okay, so one more thing that I want to show here. We've got 15 minutes. And we're at the end of this chapter. So this is the last component in this chapter. What I like to do is take a minute to show you a biological oxidation because I understand that, you know, we don't do a whole lot of biological examples. And yet most of you are biology majors. The class has got more chemistry majors in it than it has ever had before. Over time, we've had more chemistry majors come in, but, you know, with the understanding that a lot of people are really biologically oriented. And we spend all this time on small molecules. I like to take a minute and just show how some of the big biological molecules also do these same oxidations and reductions. How is it done within our bodies? And what are the reagents? Because obviously we don't have hexavalent chromium running around in our bodies doing these oxidations. And Swern oxidation that happens that produces all these gases, that's not working either. So how does the body and biological systems achieve oxidation and reduction? And there's a lot of different modes in which that works. I don't think that you need to draw all of this, but let me draw a biological reagent here for you.
And it's a big molecule. And I'm going to draw the whole molecule, and then I'll truncate it and show you what we do, how we approach it to make it a little bit easier to understand. Okay, so this guy here has double bonds in those two places. The nitrogen attaches to a sugar. So this is a sugar backbone component. That sugar connects to a phosphate. And that connects to a diphosphate, which connects to another sugar. And here I need to extend these bonds just a little bit because the next piece that comes in the bottom here is fairly large. So this is another ribose. So the sugar is ribose. And this hooks then to a nucleotide base. And this nucleotide base has double bonds, those locations, and there's an NH2 at the top of that. So this is called NADH. And NADH is a reducing agent. And the active component of it is this guy here. All the rest of it is just for solubility and for hooking into the rest of the biological molecules that it works with. So NADH, nicotine, adenine, It'll come back to me. I'll look it back up in a minute. All right, so what we're going to do is I'm going to cartoon this guy, and I'm going to say that all of this is going to be drawn just with this piece. And we'll turn this into an R group. And the neat thing about this is that when you look at the sugar and the phosphate and this whole backbone that this is attached to, is that it's all conserved with DNA. Being the sugar phosphate backbone and the nucleotides. And so this is using ribose, the part of DNA, which is the ribose sugar and the, actually, aren't it ribose, fatty acid, deoxyribose. So DNA has the deoxyribose. It's missing this one, but RNA has the ribose sugar. So this is the ribose and the phosphate. But we'll cartoon it all, and we'll just look at it as just this piece, and we'll make the R group all of the rest of this. All right, so the way that this guy works is the protons that are at the top of this molecule. There's two protons right here. And those two protons can be transferred in a reduction reaction. So if we take an aldehyde, these protons can be transferred by the lone pair of the nitrogen kicking in, pushing the electrons over, breaking one of these bonds, and giving the electrons to the oxygen. And this guy then picks up a proton, and the oxidation is complete. All right, so the question is, oh, and this is NAD plus, nicotine adenine dinucleotide. And that nicotine adenine dinucleotide can also be a reducing agent, or oxidizing agent. So watch this, watch how this can work. This guy, under the right circumstances, can receive a proton. So it can go in reverse as well. So if I take a base that pulls that proton, the electrons can kick in, moving the electrons that way, and nope, wrong way, and back out onto the nitrogen. And so we can go from NAD plus back to NADH. So any idea where we see this or have seen NAD and NADH?
I think I've seen it in like glycolysis or—
Yes, exactly. Glycolysis or the citric acid cycle. So what we do is this guy in the citric acid cycle, what happens is NAD and NADH function as the oxidizing agent and reducing agent that make this all work. And these guys function by taking ADP and converting ADP into ATP, which is really just oxidation and reduction reactions. And this thing goes back and forth all the time. And so the ability of NAD plus and NADH to go back and forth, where that H is the H that is being transferred. Actually, I did that in red, didn't I? Let's do it there. That proton, NADH, is referring to the hydrogen that's attached there. And the reason that this thing can go in cycles like this and go back and forth is the balancing act that is going on here. If you look at this nitrogen, the nitrogen has three bonds and a lone pair. The nitrogen has no positive charge, right? When it loses the proton, the lone pair kicks in and it goes to a nitrogen plus, it goes to a cation. However, the molecule turns aromatic. So it's a balancing act between being neutral and having the lone pair, or being charged and having the stability of aromaticity. The aromaticity makes it super stable. The positive charge throws it off a little bit. Over here, it loses its aromaticity, but it goes back to neutral. So these two things are so closely balanced that they bounce back and forth between these two states very, very easily, allowing it to go from its oxidized to its reduced form, allowing it to act as an oxidizing agent and as a reducing agent, and being able to bounce back and forth between those two states. It's just tuned just right in those two ways of being neutral but not aromatic, positive charge, but aromatic. And it kind of wants to be in both states. It wants to be aromatic because of the stability of aromaticity, but it doesn't want to have the positive charge. It wants to be neutral. And so Mother Nature has found this system whereby it can bounce back and forth, and it can continue to cycle within our bodies, doing this job of converting ADP to ATP, but also taking and doing the glycolysis, taking glucose and breaking it down into CO2, oxidizing the glucose and reducing ADP back to ATP, and doing this in this cycle back and forth all day long, which is just a really beautiful example of oxidation that can occur in aqueous systems where we don't need strong organic molecules in order to achieve oxidation systems or reductions. So it's just kind of a neat juxtaposition against the other chemistry that we do. And this ability to tune a molecule using different stability factors, using aromaticity as a stability factor versus being neutral as a stability factor. And they're just really, really finely tuned. Okay, so that's the pretty biological example.
It doesn't work if we get rid of the R group there.
No, it does work if you get rid of the R group, actually. Oh. It's just that the R group, you put all these hydroxyl groups on it, and what all of these guys do, and these phosphates and these negative charges, is this whole thing makes it water soluble. And so, yeah, it wouldn't be water soluble without that whole big R group. But the other thing that R group does is that this R group allows it to incorporate into a bigger biological structure. And I'm sure, and I don't know for certain, but I'm sure that this component down here, the nucleotide base, allows it to bind into other biological components so that it acts as a coenzyme rather than just a full enzyme all on its own. I think that's really what's going on there. So water solubility and the ability to hook into a larger biological system is what that R group is there for. But if you take that R group away and we put some other water-soluble R group there, then we can do oxidations in water with this just as we would in a biological system. So that's really kind of cool. Okay, where we pick it up next time is we look at a fairly small chapter of ethers and epoxides. And after ethers and epoxides, we jump into a little bit of carbonyl chemistry. And then we're going as quickly as we can into spectroscopy. So ethers and epoxides next, a little bit of aldehydes and ketones next. And then we jump into spectroscopy and start looking at how do we know what all these things actually look like? How do we analyze and be able to tell when we look at a round bottom, what is in the round bottom? How do we figure out what the structure of something is that we've never seen before? We take a complete unknown and figure out what a complete unknown looks like. That's a completely different skill set than what we've been doing. So all this time, you guys have been taking it on faith that we just know what these things are. And we've never really talked about, except for a little bit of IR, right? We've used IR, but IR can't tell you what a structure is. IR can tell you what functional groups are present, but it can't tell you what the structure is. Looking at how do we use different techniques besides IR, mass spec, proton NMR, carbon NMR, nuclear magnetic resonance. How do we use these other tools to figure out what a complete unknown structure is and go from a complete unknown to a full structure? That's where we start going with spectroscopy. And that's some really cool skill sets. So that represents a change in the type of chemistry that we're doing. And it's a lot more puzzle solving. So when we get into spectroscopy, it's all about how do I solve puzzles? And lots of puzzling. And I have lots of websites and lots of tools and lots of practice problems for you guys to do as we get into those. So a little bit more, like I said, ethers and epoxides, a little bit on aldehydes and ketones, and then we jump into some really fun stuff with spectroscopy. Okay, don't forget, the exam is live now. Exam goes through Monday. You guys are allowed to work together. And in fact, I encourage you to work together. And bring it into office hours. If you have questions, maybe I can give you some direction or point you in the right direction if you're really totally stuck. Okay? You guys know what you need to do?
Thank you.
All right. Take care. And I'll be back online at 1:30 to 2:30 for office hours.
Bye.
All right, bye-bye.
Thank you.
You're welcome.